This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There is nothing more difficult than investigating yourself, whether it's a church, a small business, a police department, even the federal government. Criticizing your own organization is not easy, and naming names is even harder. The news business is no exception. Paul Moore is public editor for the Baltimore Sun. As part of his job, he investigated when Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich banned all state officials from talking with two Sun journalists. In his column this past Sunday, Moore publicly criticized the Sun and one of its veteran columnists, as well as the governor. Paul Moore joins us now by phone from his office at the newspaper, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
First, give us a little background on the story, if you will.
Well, the story was predicated by two events in the newspaper the middle of November. An erroneous map that ran with a story describing a potential sale of Maryland parklands, and then an item in Michael Lester's column referring specifically to an expression on someone's face at a public hearing. These events triggered, I'd say, a long-standing contentious relationship with the governor into a directive to all state employees not to talk to the aforementioned two journalists.
And you looked into it, wrote about it, and described this as the most difficult column you've ever had to write.
Yeah, in the sense that there's more attention on this story in Maryland. I think we're all a little uncomfortable being in the news ourselves. And in the course of a week to 10 days, there were five news stories and two columns in the Sun about this. It was also in the Washington Post on television. So for Maryland residents and for readers of the Sun, it's a high-profile case. So it was incumbent of me to try to find a way to provide some needed perspective amidst all the rhetoric.
And did you just go – how did you go about to write it?
Well, I had formative ideas. The story was changing day by day, but I had basic points that needed to be made. In my world, it's almost like to use a sports analogy, it's almost like I'm in a conference championship game, and the world I inhabit, this is a big deal. But at the same time, it's very serious business, and there's so much rhetoric out there that I tried to clarify things. The issue is what predicated and what we did. I also believe anytime I write a column, especially in this one, there has to be voices from readers. So presenting both sides of it and try to, in a confined space, cover all the bases.
Now, you came to the conclusion in this column that that map you referred to was incorrect. The paper, in fact, the next day printed a correction, said it was wrong, but you said basically the newspaper's checks and balances had broken down under deadline, and they published the wrong map.
Exactly, and we all make mistakes in this business, but there were things, maybe we were too ambitious. Nonetheless, a story of this sensitivity and complexity should have had more vetting, and we were culpable in that regard. I don't think it predicated at all what the response from the government was, but certainly our inability to execute on deadline was a problem.
More serious, you said, was the columnist, Mr. Oreskes, saying that a public official had trouble reading a statement with a straight face when, in fact, he was not at the meeting.
Yeah, and quite frankly, I think this has been the more serious of the two issues. Mr. Olesker sees it in terms of metaphorical usage, but in the column represents the same strictures as any news story does in terms of factual basis. I think, as I called it in the column, a lapse in judgment, and I felt I had to be as forthright about this situation or my credibility and the newspaper's credibility would not be worth enough.
How difficult is it to come to that conclusion and publish it in the newspaper? Well, I don't think Mr. Olesker probably sits very far away from you.
He sits right outside my door. He's a friend of mine. But being a friend and a colleague are one thing. I have a responsibility to readers, and in a sense, I am their representative. And I felt strongly that if I didn't make what I felt was important and what I think readers who gave me feedback felt was important, and also colleagues, I was not going to do my job. And that's paramount. So the uncomfortableness was there, but the reasons to do it, I have to call them as I see them, and this was a case where I had to do it.
And furthermore, if you don't call them as you see them, and criticize your colleagues there at the newspaper. Your biggest point in that column, that the governor is at fault for barring access to two reporters and using the power of the state to enforce that, that point is lost altogether.
Absolutely. I mean, you it is a two-way street. I think adversarial relationships between elected officials and the press are, in some sense, normal. I think this has become an abnormal situation, way beyond probably the necessary thing. As I point out, I think there are things beneath the surface on this issue in terms of political ramifications, the governor and his base. And I the thing that's been amazing to me is the amount of response that I've gotten from readers before the column since, on all sides of the fence. But what you see is tremendous interest in this issue of free press access and the possible banishment of certain individuals in the business.
Two questions. Do you see this as a vindication of the of your role as public editor there at the Baltimore Sun? And on consideration, is this a job you would take again?
Good question. Vindication, I don't think I'd go that far. I mean, I think anyone in this kind of job, an ombudsman at NPR or at other newspapers, we have a responsibility. We are an independent voice. And yet, I do work for the newspaper. I care about the newspaper very much. Its credibility matters to me personally and professionally. So if I'm not capable of dealing with that and expressing that, I wouldn't be doing my job. Check with me in a couple of years on whether I've been in this job 8 months after being in the newsroom in a management capacity for a number of years. It's an incredible challenge, but I'll say this. If I ever go back to be an editor, I'm going to know a lot more than I did before. I have more respect than ever for readers.
And one thing you know is never to talk to that public editor.
That might be a good idea.
Paul Moore, thanks very much for being with us, and
thank
good luck.
Thank you very much, sir.
Paul Moore, public editor for the Baltimore Sun. He joined us by phone from his office in Maryland. In the ancient Scandinavian language, the word ombudsman meant the man who sees to it that the snow and ice and rubbish are removed from the streets and that the chimneys are swept. Arthur Nauman, the former ombudsman of the Sacramento Bee, gave that definition in a 1994 speech on press regulation in Seoul, South Korea. He said it was discovered by an American college student while researching her master's degree thesis, and she said that it is rather fitting, as the ombudsman role is to sweep down barriers between the public and the media. While today the ombudsman might not do much sweeping, the in-house critic has become a familiar sight at many news institutions. The first U.S. ombudsman was established at the Louisville Times in 1967. The New York Times just added their own public editor in 2003. Today we'll discuss the role of ombudsman, and we invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever called a public editor or an ombudsman to express a concern or a complaint or sent an email? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now to talk about the role of news ombudsman are Jeffrey Dvorkin, NPR's ombudsman. He's with us here in Studio 3A. And Jeffrey, always good to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us is Ian Mays. He's the reader's editor. I guess that's another euphemism for the same phrase, ombudsman, at the Guardian newspaper in London. And he's with us here in Studio 3A as well. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
I am pleased to be here. Yes, it's another word for ombudsman.
Jeffrey, you've been listening to Paul Moore. I wonder if you've—I don't think you've been in a similar situation, one as difficult as that yet.
Not quite. I think I sympathize with what a tough job Paul had to do with very few months' experience behind him. But I think the role of the ombudsman is to prove to both your colleagues inside the news organization and to your listeners or readers that you actually are independent. And we all come up to those tests at some point in our lifespan as ombudsmen or readers' representatives, and we have to prove that we are independent by kicking appropriately the journalists in the shins and management in the shins as is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Ian, have you ever had a similar situation at The Guardian, a difficult column?
I've been in that kind of situation quite frequently. In fact, I think most ombudsmen are in something like that situation for most of the time. It's a bit like being a referee in a very, very rough football match, let's say, with, in The Guardian's case, say, about 370 staff journalists on one side, and of the paper alone, 1.2 million or something like that, readers on the other, or many more millions on the website, which a lot of American citizens use. and you're in the middle, and then your independence and impartiality and all those other things that you try to bring to the job are severely tested, as Paul's were in this case. But it sounds to me as though Paul has done a great service both to the Baltimore Sun and to its readers in the way he's conducted this one.
The Guardian caused a bit of a stir in this country not so long ago during the presidential election campaign when it called for its readers to write to some undecided voters in Clark County, Ohio, and influence, possibly, how they might decide to vote. Did you look into that in The Guardian, and what conclusion did you come to?
Really, this is the first I've heard of this.
No,
that's not true. Yes, I did, and I came to the conclusion that it had acted a little, what should I say, it was a bit of an unfortunate exercise. I criticised the paper for a number of things. One, although the way in which it purchased access to the reader list in Clark County was legal, I still think that it was intrusive and uncomfortable to make the kind of use of it that it did. I try to put myself in the position, say, of a British reader in a sensitive area during a sensitive election, getting a letter from someone, I don't know, in Japan or Germany, seeking to persuade me to vote one way or the other.
The Guardian did bring an end to this campaign.
The campaign ended, and it's a bit of a moot point whether The Guardian ended it or whether the campaign was ended by default. What happened was the site that was being used for this exchange, or whatever you would call it, was hacked into, I understand, and therefore the exercise no longer became tenable for that reason. But actually, I think it was an exercise that had already gone too far.
If you want to get in our conversation about ombudsman public editors, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with David, who's with us from Spokane, Washington.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I really believe in ombudspersons and throughout all kinds of organizations, including the media, and I've used them before. Spokesman Review here in Spokane had an ombudsman, and that position was ended after several months of using an ombudsman. I would have loved to have seen an ombudsman still in place recently. You know, the newspaper here has cut back the length that your letter to the editor can be, so it's more difficult to express your thoughts and your reactions to the news. Recently, one thing that happened here was when Fahrenheit 9/11 played in a local theater.
The Michael Moore movie, yeah.
Right. There were uniformed Spokane police officers stationed outside the doors of the theaters in which it was shown the first day. And when the article ran in the newspaper a few days later mentioning that, they referred to them as off-duty police officers. So I started calling and asking, look, these guys are in uniform, they're wearing a taxpayer-paid badge, gun, et cetera. And when I talked to the reporter that wrote the article, he said, well, that word was added later. I just wrote police officers. So I did some calling around to the police, et cetera, and it was explained to me that these guys are on-duty officers. They're called extra-duty officers, but they're on-duty. And I had to fight with an editor there for several minutes on the phone with him making all kinds of arguments about why does it matter, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm explaining to him what matters because facts are facts. He was either on duty or off duty. And so in the end, they did print a correction saying that these were on duty police officers. And, you know, small facts are important. And if you're having trouble getting a newspaper to acknowledge the facts, it's good to have somebody who is, you know, they may work for the newspaper, but at least they're educated in this philosophy of what an ombudsperson does, and they should hopefully have some high personal standards and ethics and commitment to the public, because that's what the job's all about.
Okay, David, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. We're going to take more of your calls and emails when we return from a short break. Our number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Back after a short break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about ombudsmen, the public editors who serve as readers or listeners' advocates at their news organizations. And we're taking your calls. Have you ever contacted your newspaper, radio station, or TV station with a question or concern or correction? What happened? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guests are Jeffrey Dvorkin, who's NPR's ombudsman, and Ian Mays, who performs that same function as reader's editor for the British newspaper The Guardian. They are also president and vice president, respectively, of the Organization of News Ombudsmen. And Jeffrey, I'm sure I'm not the first person to point out that the acronym reads, oh no.
And what an appropriate acronym it is for an ombudsman. Oh, no. And it's a growing group of people, international group of readers' representatives and broadcasters. I think we're up to about 90, which isn't enormous, but it's double what it was of even only a few years ago. And more are joining almost monthly.
Let's get another listener on the line. Tom is calling us from Bloomington, Minnesota.
Yes.
Go ahead, Tom.
It's my belief that newspapers in particular have a tendency to only hire employees who share their political and social philosophy. Therefore, how can they convince the public that their ombudsmen are doing a service to the public rather than to the newspaper?
Ian.
Well, that's a good question. I think that basically the ombudsman, it's up to the ombudsman to demonstrate over a period that he is acting impartially in the interests of readers, if you like. And I think there are two essential things for an ombudsman. One is independence, and the other is visibility. There isn't any point in having an ombudsman if you don't tell your readers, listeners, viewers that you've got one. And in my case, my terms of reference and the guarantee that I've got of my independence is posted on The Guardian's website. So the whole idea is to keep it as open as possible. In my contract, for instance, I can't be sacked by the editor. I can't be dismissed. This is my most enviable quality in the eyes of most British journalists. He can't interfere with what I write. He can't veto subjects that I want to write about. To dismiss me, he'd have to call a meeting of the Scott Trust, which owned The Guardian, and they'd have to do it by a majority vote.
Probably get in the newspapers and so be a big, ugly thing.
It would be incredibly embarrassing for them, to put it mildly.
Yeah. Unless you did something terrible, but in any case.
Unless I did something terrible, and I finally flipped under pressure.
But what about Tom's point? Did you work at The Guardian before you were
yes.
hired?
Yes, yeah, I did. Paid by The Guardian, but I think that my background was in sort of regional journalism. In other words, I was working for a local evening newspaper. And I think that every journalist who works in that situation, which I still think is the best way to train, has a choice to make. Are you going to be absorbed into local society, or are you going to learn to be decently independent and to stand back from it and report it? And I found that invaluable to me, and the decision I took then, to me in working in a newsroom where the story is the organization, the media organization, whether it's a newspaper, a radio station, television station, that you're employed by. And so that's a great help to have that degree of detachment.
Jeffrey, before you were ombudsman, you held a very important management position here at NPR News. How do you convince your readers that you're independent of NPR management?
Well, and it was a problem. When I started this job 4.5, almost 5 years ago now, I had to prove through the columns that I write on the weekly on the NPR website that I was willing to take on some of the sacred cows and the holy cows of NPR. And I tried to do that in a way that wasn't just padding my resume. I needed to find ways to draw attention to myself as the ombudsman. So for the first year, maybe some would say for the first 4.5 years, I've been a bit of a shameless self-promoter for the idea of that NPR has an ombudsman. And if the volume of emails about NPR is any indication, I think people have noticed last year I processed over 50,000 emails about NPR and public radio, not all about NPR, but mostly about NPR, and that excludes porn, spam, the usual stuff. It's something that you have to proceed with quite diligently. As someone who wrote to me shortly after I took the job and left management, which I'd done for 17 years in a couple of guises, said, well, you know, really, ombudsmen are sort of the chiropractors of journalism. There are a lot of adjustments, but no cures. And I hope ombudsman or the ombudsman from chiropractic institutions don't write me on this one.
Well, it's not the ombudsman's role to defend the organization that he or she is working for. In fact, you could say that the best way that, or the best service that an ombudsman can render the organization that he or she is working for is to demonstrate impartiality and independence.
But what was interesting was that the idea of having an in-house critic was hard for a number of people inside NPR to accept at first. Mm-hmm. And there are still a couple of editors around who I think are not very happy that I do what I do. But tough noogies, as we say in the ombudsman business. It's just you have to be able to set that aside and say you're doing this for the benefit of the organization and the listeners they purport to serve. Mm-hmm.
But somewhat predicated on Tom's question, he's still on the line, is the idea that The Guardian describes itself as a left-of-center newspaper. Should it be served by hiring an ombudsman who agrees more or less with that, or somebody from a different political perspective?
Yeah, well, I don't really consider myself to be a left-of-centre, journalist, and I never have. In a sense, I've been an apolitical journalist. I think that the best kind of journalism has got a strong public service element in it, and that's the kind of journalism that I like. That's the kind of journalism that I'm sure you've got here, you know, on NPR. It's the kind of journalism that the BBC has tried to practice, mm-hmm. where I worked for a few years, some time ago. And I think without that kind of view of its role, you know, then the media really starts to fail and flounder.
Tom, thank you very much for the question.
Okay.
Let me ask you a little bit about what your day is like. And I have to begin with a question. Ian, when you go out and get the newspaper first thing in the morning, or Jeffrey, when you turn on the radio and there's Morning Edition, is the first thing you look out for is, oh, this is what I'm going to be dealing with all day long?
Yes. Sometimes that happens. You know that there are certain issues that get people going, whether it's about issues around media bias, issues around the coverage of the Middle East, the use of language. Certainly there was a lot of fuss and continues to be a lot of fuss about Bob Edwards' departure from NPR. And you know that there will be times when that this will be what you are dealing with. And I've got a DSL line at home, so I turn on the computer before I go outside to get the newspaper, just to see what the overnight flow of emails and the email traffic has been. And it's sort of like looking at the early exit polls, as it were. You have a pretty good indication of, or not, as the case may be, of which way things are going to develop over the next day or so.
I like to start each day. I like the unpredictability of it. That's what particularly keeps me going in it. And you gain, I think, increasing respect for readers.
How many emails do you get a day, Ian?
Well, in the course of a year, I get about 10,000, and it varies from you know, one day to another.
And Jeffrey, hundreds, thousands a day?
Last year, 50,000 during the election campaign.
My math isn't that quick.
it was running around 12,000 a month over the summer, and it dropped a little bit after the election, but it's starting to come up again as people are insisting that NPR and other news organizations are failing to cover the story of the so-called stolen election. Mm-hmm. That has really energized a lot of people, and NPR has addressed that issue, I'm happy to
that's
say.
That's about 400 a day.
400, thank you.
That's about the number of letters to the editor that we get in normal times, but then, of course, I don't edit letters to the editor. That's a distinction. I just deal with the complaints.
Would either of you, do you think, have your jobs if email did not exist?
Probably it would be quite different. I think that email has made it much easier for people to express their points of view, sometimes with thought behind it and sometimes without a lot of thought behind it. But email is an easy way of making the democracy a much more viable and responsive institution, and the media has a role to play in that. Mm-hmm.
Well, I started in 1997. I was the first ombudsman of this kind in British journalism. And email was just building up then. I've watched it build up and take over as the main sort of source of my correspondence. And again, I agree with Jeffrey, it's a very democratic kind of medium. We make it as easy as possible for people to complain about anything that they don't like in the paper. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, they do.
Let's get another caller on the line. Anne is with us from Walnut Creek, California.
Hi, Mr. Dvorkin. How are you?
Hello, Anne. I recognize your voice.
Right.
One of my regular correspondents.
We are on a first-name basis, you might say.
I hope so.
Right. Well, my question to you was, do you agree, as I feel, that an ombudsman should be concerned not just about errors of commission or complaints about things that have been said in the publication or on the air, but also errors of omission? And you know that I probably drove you crazy with my constant calls, you know, why aren't you telling this story? Why aren't you telling it completely? And interestingly, The Guardian was the publication that wrote up the project for a new American century, the 90-page white paper written in the 1990s about, by the neoconservatives, a plan for new world domination by the U.S. First we invade Iraq, and I had been asking you over and over again.
It's something we've also discussed on this program, but Jeffrey, the question.
Well, the question that Anne asks is, what are we missing? And there are occasionally, and sometimes more than just occasionally, stories that news organizations in general and NPR in particular do miss. And I do write about them in the column, and I bring them to the attention of the editors. And there are a lot of stories that listeners suggest through me that do end up as stories on the air. So, Anne is quite right. The Project for a New American Century is something that NPR has covered, and I think Anne has been right to point it out.
Occasionally we miss things that we should have covered, and readers ring me up and complain that they haven't been covered properly. And one of the sources of complaint were early protest marches against the war in Iraq, for instance, mm-hmm. that didn't, in readers' opinion, get proper coverage. And since then, they have done. Of course, they've been huge. Mm-hmm.
And the same at NPR. NPR was accused of not covering the anti-war movement sufficiently in the lead-up to the war.
We were also accused of not covering the pro-war movement.
Well, I think I got more emails accusing us of not covering the anti-war movement, and I think that was rectified after a few phone calls and a column or two. And I thought NPR managed to correct itself, and I don't know if it would have done that without the sense of outrage, frankly, from many listeners.
Mm-hmm. And we thank you for your outrage.
Thank you, and I just wanted to say that if there's any holy occupation, it is journalism done properly.
Okay, we will take our vows and take a one-second break for collective thoughts.
Thanks
here.
A lot.
Anne, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I want to ask you, your contract, Ian, you said, allows you a great deal of autonomy. Jeffrey, I know yours does as well. What if in the totally unlikely circumstance that somebody with a really neat Scandinavian title makes a mistake on their own? Who's responsible for the ombudsman's errors?
Well, often the listeners are, or certainly the readers of my column, point out mistakes that I've made, and I go back the next week and put them on the column. So I think that ombudsmen should be just as open about their mistakes as we try to hold you journalists accountable for yours.
Mm-hmm. I run a corrections column in the Guardian every day. It appears on the main comment page of the paper every day. It's quite prominent. And any mistakes that I make or that are made by anyone on my behalf, we correct straight away because we have to. Mm.
Let's get another caller on the line. Jonathan is with us from Hood River, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi. So
thanks for taking my call. I have a question that has been baffling me for a long time now. The practice of newspapers endorsing a candidate during elections has always kind of baffled me. Newspapers supposed to be objective and impartial. Just like to hear some comments on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a representative of a newspaper here, Ian. What do you think?
Okay, well, I mean, newspapers in the United Kingdom are a bit different from newspapers in the United States or perhaps anywhere else in the world. They represent a huge spectrum, and they do divide politically. I was talking about regional journalism a little while ago. One of the reasons why I like it so much is that it doesn't define its readership politically. It just defines it geographically.
Mm-hmm. But the demographic that The Guardian goes
the
after is
Guardian
political.
Is more likely in the to support a candidate of the sort of centre-left than one of the right. I don't think it's ever supported a conservative government, but would it support, say, Tony Blair's government in a forthcoming election? I'm not altogether certain about that.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, in this country, newspapers do, radio and television organizations generally do not, but can't speak for newspapers. But.
Right, but and I think that NPR is frequently criticized, well, it's criticized for being both too left and too right these days. But it has a reputation left over from its more youthful era of being counterculture-ish, maybe a bit on the left side of things, by its choice of stories and how it treats the stories. And I think that NPR has made a pretty significant step in making sure that it has broadened its approach in the kinds of stories it covers and the voices of opinion that it puts on the radio. So I think that it is not as obviously sympathetic, perhaps, as it may once have been 10 years ago. You'd be in a better position to, since you predate me here by a couple of years, to determine that. But as a print colleague of mine once noticed, writing an editorial, he said, or a leader, as you say in England,
yeah.
Is like, as he put it, wetting yourself in a blue serge suit. It makes you feel warm all over and nobody notices.
Jonathan, I think at least part of the answer is that newspapers endorse candidates. They're endorsed by the editorial board, not by the newspaper per se, and there's supposed to be a distinction between the editorial endorsement and the rest of the newspaper. I think what you're talking about is a bit of confusion that I think is quite understandable, that people would see that if the newspaper endorses candidate X, that their coverage of candidate Y might be a little bit skewed in that respect, or at least they might come away with that conclusion.
Exactly. That's the heart of my question, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to continue with your calls on this question after a short break, which we have to go to now. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. We're also going to be switching focus after the break and talking about the resignation today of Kwasi Mfume as the president of the NAACP. So if you want to get in on that conversation, the phone number and the email address are the same. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about ombudsmen, the public editors who represent listeners or readers of news organizations. With us are two of the above. Ian Mays is the readers editor with The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, and Jeffrey Dvorkin is ombudsman here at National Public Radio News. You're invited to join our conversation, 800-989-8255. And let's go to Eric. Eric's been very patient on the line from Hilton Head in South Carolina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And also, more importantly, thank you for the timeliness of this conversation personally. I have a quick little tale to tell. I am a youth advisor at our church here of a group of teenagers, and we are a Unitarian church, and I decided it would be a good idea if we had officials elected, and as we were discussing the different possibilities, secretary, president, vice president, being Unitarians, a lot of things are up for debate. And the conversation kind of started to spiral a little out of control. So I suggested that maybe we should elect an ombudsman first to help both. And when I suggested that, I got a lot of blank stares as to what does that mean? What is an ombudsman? So this was probably one of the first times that an ombudsman was the first person elected. And I described the position as being kind of the dispute solver and the problem solver, both within the organization and with the public at large and our outreach.
That's an interesting description. Now, Jeffrey, I know you've used the word conscience of a news organization.
Well, I think it's also a balancing act. I think that on the one hand, the goal of an ombudsman is to create more accountability and transparency for the public inside a news organization, and at the same time to raise the standards of media literacy outside, because often people don't have a clear idea of what a news organization is doing or is trying to do or for whom it's doing it, and so that there is a sense of creating this balance between accountability and transparency.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you for the show.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's talk with Maureen. Maureen's in Salisbury, Maryland.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to ask about, what about smaller communities? I'm in a very small market. In fact, I have worked in news here in print and television, and we get the people straight out of school as reporters, and there are markets that don't believe they can afford an ombudsman. I'd argue that maybe they can afford not to have one. But we get some pretty questionable reporting as a result. I know there was a shooting in my former neighborhood, and the reporter quoted one person who said that there's guns going off here all the time, and it really didn't surprise me. There was no balance for that quote with, say, statistics, or it was let to stand by itself, and mm-hmm. No, I contacted the editor. But it just left me very concerned about what happens in markets this size.
Well, Ian, you work for a national newspaper, but as you said, you've also worked in the regional press, so...
Yeah, I have. So far, no regional newspapers in Britain have got an ombudsman. But I personally think that it would be quite easy to adapt the ombudsman system to small organisations. You simply give the ombudsman a contract which gives him or her independence and guarantees while they're performing that function. And so it's easier to do that in terms of, say, someone with mainly managerial functions other than that. But I think it's perfectly possible to, so to speak, give the ombudsman a hat which he puts on when he's performing that particular function. And while he's got his hat on, he's got the same sort of guarantees that Jeffrey's got and I've got.
Mm-hmm. The other example is Paul Jacoby in Providence, Rhode Island, who is an ombudsman for the local television station, a commercial television station. He's a lawyer in town who does this on a kind of pro bono way and does a wonderful job. And maybe there's a possibility on the eastern shore of Maryland that that some person like that could be found as well.
I think you might find half the former editorial board of the Washington Post on the eastern shore of Maryland.
There you go.
I'm sure they are. Thanks for taking the call.
Okay, Maureen. Let me ask both of you before we let you go, what do you now know about the public and your readership and your listenership that you didn't know before? Ian.
I think I know quite a lot about them. One, there are an awful lot of them who are a lot brighter than me or many of my colleagues. I think that you develop an increasing respect for them. And you've got to think of what kind of relationship you want with them. And if you want the kind of relationship which results in a civilised conversation of the sort that I think we've all been having here this afternoon, then you address readers accordingly and you deal with their complaints like you're two grown-ups.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey?
They're passionate. Public radio listeners they have very good hearing. They understand nuance and subtlety. They know when they're being flanneled and maybe even taken for a ride, and they can express it with great intensity. But I think the issue for me, as it is for Ian, is how do you create an environment where the dialogue is about civic issues and done in a civil manner? And I think that in these very difficult times that we're in now, the need for that kind of those kinds of values of dialogue and moderation and tolerance are something that that has been expressed to me by many, many listeners. They're very eager to hear that kind of relationship among various constituencies in this country. And that's been a wonderful experience. It makes me very proud to be an ombudsman and to work for NPR.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, thanks very much for being with us. Jeffrey Dvorkin is NPR's ombudsman. He was with us here in Studio 3A, along with Ian Mays, the reader's editor for The Guardian newspaper in London. And thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.